Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Noam Chomsky, MIT professor of linguistics, author, political analyst, and activist, who talks about the Syrian crisis and examines the repeated rationale for American military intervention based on the need to maintain Washington's credibility as the world's policeman. U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut, who criticizes the recent congressional compromise that ties student loan rates to financial markets. And John Goodwin of the Humane Society of the United States, who explains why his group is working to remove the King Amendment from this year's congressional farm bill that would repeal state laws protecting animal welfare. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The future of legal dissent in Iraq is in doubt after security forces suppressed a protest over government pensions in late August. Police denied a permit for a rally in front of Parliament and closed off roads and bridges blocking anti-government activists. Despite the Iraqi crackdown, hundreds of protesters turned out in many cities across Iraq to decry the decline of pension payments distributed by the government of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch condemned the Iraqi government for refusing to grant protest permits, asserting that the Interior Ministry was afraid that open dissent would be politically embarrassing or inconvenient as opposed to presenting a credible threat of violence. Despite millions of dollars spent by the U.S. on promoting democratic institutions in Iraq, protest leader Ahmad Ibrahim complained, "People are fed up with the situation 10 years after the U.S. invasion. Iraq is moving backward, not forward." In 1956, Soviet soldiers ordered citizens out of their homes in present-day Kananerka, Kazakhstan, before nuclear bomb tests were about to be carried out at a nearby military test site. Village resident Anastasia Kaisaleva recalls that residents who ran towards the radioactive bomb blast either died or became very ill. Since the breakup of the Soviet Union in 1991 and the founding of Kazakhstan and four other Central Asian nations as independent states, Washington has funded efforts to locate secret Soviet test sites and nuclear material. In 2012, scientists searching the former Soviet Sampalatinsk nuclear site recovered 400 pounds of plutonium, enough material to build a dozen nuclear weapons. The Obama White House is now in talks about how to safely remove the plutonium. It's still unknown if all the radioactive material from the Cold War era has been identified and recovered in Kazakhstan. The situation is in some ways similar to that faced by residents living near America's Cold War nuclear test sites in the Nevada desert, where dangerous nuclear burial sites may still lurk undiscovered. In early September, Ford and General Motors announced major increases in car sales and profits, even as the city of Detroit, once the hub of the nation's auto industry, is mired in bankruptcy. Detroit city workers, retirees, and majority African-American population now face a new austerity budget and more service cuts. Ironically, downtown Detroit is currently booming, with a $650 million sports arena, an entertainment district, new restaurants, and nightclubs, attracting young college-educated residents. The news magazine In These Times reports that Quicken founder Dan Gilbert is buying up downtown real estate, telling the Detroit News that the bankruptcy filing is a short-term problem, even as the Motor City has lost 25% of its population over the last decade and laid off a third of its police force. Hope for Detroit's future may rest with the new wave of young adults that have moved into rundown Detroit neighborhoods, so-called urban pioneers, who are resettling the abandoned urban landscape with upscale stores, urban farms, and manufacturing startups. The optimism about Detroit's future, fueled by a new city plan supported by foundations, largely ignores the pain and suffering of the city's poor, who often are forced to cobble together several part-time jobs to survive. The juxtaposition of blighted neighborhoods against the now gleaming gentrified downtown and midtown areas increasingly evokes descriptions of the new Detroit as a Dickensian two-tiered city. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
After the August 21st mass casualty chemical weapons attack in Syria that Washington claimed was launched by the Syrian government, President Obama announced that a red line had been crossed and that President Bashar al-Assad's regime needed to be punished with U.S. airstrikes. But after the British Parliament rejected Prime Minister David Cameron's call to join an American attack on Syria, there has been little international support for military intervention, with the exception of France and Turkey. With the near certainty of Russian and Chinese vetoes of any American bid for UN Security Council authorization for an attack on Syria, and no approval by the Arab League, President Obama turned to the U.S. Congress to try and gain some legitimacy for U.S. intervention in Syria's brutal civil war, underway since 2011. But there, too, Democratic and Republican legislators alike, reflecting overwhelming public opposition to U.S. involvement in another Middle East war, appear to be moving toward a decisive defeat of an Obama war resolution. Then something unexpected happened. Secretary of State John Kerry, speaking off the cuff at a London press conference, proposed then dismissed the idea of Syria avoiding a U.S. military strike by allowing international monitors to take custody of, then destroy, Syria's chemical weapons arsenal. The Russians embraced the idea and not long after convinced the Syrian government to agree to the still vague plan. As if being thrown a lifeline in the midst of an untenable political crisis, President Obama characterized the plan as a possible diplomatic breakthrough. Now, as a congressional vote on U.S. airstrikes is delayed, there is cautious hope that a deal can be hammered out at the United Nations Security Council. Your reporter spoke with Noam Chomsky, linguistics and philosophy professor emeritus at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and longtime peace and social justice activist. Here, Professor Chomsky talks about the Syrian crisis and examines the repeated rationale for American military intervention based on the need to maintain Washington's credibility as the world's policeman.
What the effect would be on the ground, well, we can't be certain, but chances are very high, and I think almost all well-informed specialists agree that U.S. Military action of some kind would simply heighten the level of confrontation. Any arms that are sent in from either side just leads to a counter-reaction and reestablishes the confrontation, the military confrontation, at an even higher and more brutal level. So I think the question we ought to really be asking is, what are the objectives of the Obama administration, the civilians in the government? And they've been pretty frank about it. And I tend to think that what they're saying is accurate. What they say is that the crucial issue is what they call American credibility. People must follow our orders. If not, we're not going to be able to impose our orders in other places. Now that they don't put it exactly in those terms. They do talk about establishing credibility. But that's what it means. Credibility means you better do what we say or else. This is a familiar notion. It appears over and over again in world affairs, and it's familiar in other domains too. So, say, take the mafia. I mean, if the Godfather produces an edict, he's going to make sure that everyone obeys it, because if anyone disobeys, even a small storekeeper somewhere, the whole system might erode. That's the way international affairs works. Sometimes it's called the domino theory. If we don't enforce our rule in this place, the dominoes will start to fall, and pretty soon the system will erode.
As the Russian initiative is an example of, it seems apparent that a negotiated settlement of this conflict has not yet been exhausted.
The way out of this is some form of negotiations and diplomacy. And fortunately, it seems that there may be an opening for that now. The Russians picked up an inadvertent comment by John Kerry. It's clear he didn't mean it, but he said that he was asked at a news conference whether there was any way in which Syria might avoid the American military action. He said, yes, if they get rid of all their weapons of mass destruction. Well, the Russians followed immediately by a proposal to Syria that their chemical weapons supplies be placed under international inspection and under national control, and that steps be undertaken to eliminate them. And Syria pretty much seems to have agreed. Okay, that's diplomacy and negotiations. That's a way out of the narrow conflict if the Obama administration accepts it. A broader approach would be to pursue the appeal of the UN negotiator, Lakhdar Brahimi, a very good person, to move towards more general negotiations. These are what are called the Geneva negotiations on trying to establish some kind of transitional government in which Assad would slowly be eased out of power and some new regime would be established. Well, that's the best hope for a settlement. It's a slim hope, but it's the best one there is.
Just a last quick question, if I could, Professor Chomsky, and that is, in 1991, when the first President Bush, H.W. Bush, launched the Persian Gulf War, he declared the Vietnam Syndrome over. But, of course, now we have public opinion decidedly against the Obama administration's push to attack Syria. And it looks like we have a new Iraq syndrome developed from the second George Bush's adventure there. Is this a welcome development in your view?
What's called the Vietnam syndrome is a very interesting notion. That means the unwillingness of the population to engage in aggressive war. Vietnam was a war of aggression. We invaded South Vietnam, later all of Indochina, killed millions of people, destroyed the countries, a major war crime. In my view, the Vietnam syndrome was very welcome. Opposition to aggression should always be welcomed. And I think it's continued. The invasion of Iraq was a remarkable event in many ways. It's the first time in history that there was massive public opposition to a war demonstrated by huge demonstrations even before the war broke out. There's nothing like that prior to the Iraq invasion. And that had a big effect. I mean, there's fluctuations, like sometimes a war fever is stirred up. But it's a pretty steady process of a reduction of support for aggressive military action abroad. And I think that's a good thing for any state.
That was Noam Chomsky, MIT Professor Emeritus of Linguistics, author, political analyst, and activist. Listen to the full half-hour interview with Professor Chomsky about Syria by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Every year, millions of students graduate from American colleges and universities billions of dollars in debt. Earlier this year, after much debate, Congress adopted legislation that rolled back student loan interest rates but tied the rates to the financial markets, which means that over time, those rates will surely rise. U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren, Democrat of Massachusetts, introduced a bill that would have made student loan rates the same as those charged to the nation's largest banks when they borrow funds from the Federal Reserve, 0.75%. But the legislation was defeated. For the coming school year, the interest rate for undergraduates is 3.86% and for graduate students, 5.41%. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Connecticut senior U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal, who has been an outspoken critic of exorbitant student loan rates. He supported Senator Warren's bill and proposed expanding the federal government's pay-as-you-earn program that reduces payments for some graduates based on the size of their family and income after graduation. Here, Senator Blumenthal explains why Congress as a whole rejected Senator Warren's interest rate plan and what steps he's advocating to reduce the burden on students facing ballooning college debt.
I voted against the bill eventually signed by the president because it means temporarily low interest rates, but eventually a very drastic increase in the charges to students on these interest rates up to 8.25%, and the rates are climbing. So it's really a very, very short-sighted and short-term gain at the expense of long-term pain and much increased costs for the students of next year and succeeding years. And we need lower interest rates for students. In fact, I've supported a measure that would give students rates the best regard to the big banks, when they borrow from the Federal Reserve, when the big banks borrow from the Federal Reserve, they're charged less than a percentage point, 0.75%. Why not give students the benefit of the same rate? We have to view student loans as an investment, not a help to students, but an investment in their future and our nation's future. Last year, at 3.4%, the federal government made $51 billion off the backs of students. That is unconscionable. For the government to profit from the student loan program is unacceptable, and we ought to be giving students the benefit of the same rates that we charge to the big banks, which are presumably deficit neutral, costless, and we need to view the student loan program as an investment in the future of our students and America, because we need those skills.
What's in the way of Congress agreeing to make student loan rates the same as bank loan rates?
Members of Congress very tragically see the student loan program as a way to solve the deficit and the debt. They see it as producing revenue for the federal government. But we can make smart cuts, not the kind of counter-interest cuts that the student loan program has suffered over the years. There is a way to solve the deficit and the debt problem with smart cuts, a balanced approach that eliminates some federal spending and raises some revenue, but not on the backs of students who are our future. And we ought to view this investment as very critical to our national interests as much as our national defense or any other essential government investment.
Senator Dick Blumenthal, can you give me any specifics on ways that excessive student debt negatively impacts the economy and you know, the whole issue of jobs?
As much as I'm concerned about the levels of interest rates now on student loans, I'm equally, if not more, concerned about the trillion-plus dollars in existing debt from past years. And that is not only financially crushing to those people who have borrowed, but it's also a tremendous weight and drag on the economy. Those people who owe tens of thousands of dollars in debt cannot start new businesses, build homes, form families, because they are mired down by debt. So consumer spending is dragged down by the tens of thousands of dollars that each person owes, an average of about $29,000 for every student now graduating in Connecticut. And that $1.2 trillion in debt is a tremendous drag on the economy.
What do you think is the solution to the student debt debacle?
For existing student debt, there are basically three legs to the solution. One is to reduce interest rates on new student loans. The other is to provide means of students having opportunities for debt relief, for repayment relief on the existing debt. And I've urged and I've proposed legislation to expand the pay-as-you-earn program so that students don't have to wait 20 years before their debt can be relieved, and the public service program that recognizes students for what they give back, whether in teaching or providing medical services. If they work in the community, if they provide service, their work ought to be recognized and their debt forgiven, at least in part. And there are ways to expand existing programs, but also change the tax code so as to enable students to have repayment options that they lack right now. And the third leg of dealing with student debt is to reduce the cost of tuition, drive down the costs of higher education in college, and also reduce costs, for example, of textbooks and other expenses that students have. We need to drive down the cost of college. Some of the for-profit colleges are making very large amounts of revenue without providing sufficiently valued product. Some of the charges in colleges, put aside tuition, the living expenses in dorms and so forth, can be driven down. So we need a national strategy to drive down the cost of tuition.
I've read some horrible stories about how for-profit colleges and training institutes prey, especially on low-income young people. They promise them jobs, but don't follow through. What kind of regulations are they under?
There are proposals that I've made to regulate more strictly or oversee and scrutinize the for-profit colleges. Some have improved, but many of the practices that prey on lower-income students and on our veterans continue to exist. And so I think we need to take a hard look at the for-profit colleges. An investigation released last year by Senator Harkin and myself showed that many, many people leave the for-profit colleges without degrees, but with huge amounts of debt.
That was U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut. For more information on continuing efforts to address unsustainable student debt, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. This year's Congressional Farm Bill, that sets policy for many federal agricultural programs, has been the focus of controversy. The House version of the bill, approved by the majority Republicans, voted to increase farm subsidies to giant agribusiness companies while completely eliminating the food stamp program that assists millions of the nation's poor families. The GOP will separately propose a measure that will cut $40 billion over 10 years from food stamps before moving to a House-Senate conference committee on the Farm Bill. But another contentious, although less discussed, legislative plank in the Farm Bill relates to the so-called King Amendment. This amendment, proposed by Iowa Republican Representative Steve King, would prevent states from enforcing their own laws regarding the production of agricultural products, a term so broad that it could include not only farm animals, but also dogs and puppy mills. According to groups whose mission is to prevent cruelty to animals, if this provision is enacted, many animal welfare standards set at the state level could be eliminated. Opponents of the King Amendment say the measure threatens current regulations outlawing extreme confinement of animals in factory farms, as well as bans on horse slaughter and eating dogs and cats for food. In addition, the amendment would prevent states from passing any new laws to protect animal welfare. Your reporter spoke with John Goodwin, Director of Animal Cruelty Policy at the Humane Society of the United States, who explains why his group and many others around the country are working hard to remove the King Amendment from the final version of this year's Farm Bill.
When the Farm Bill was debated in the House Agriculture Committee, that committee accepted by a voice vote an amendment offered by Congressman Steve King of Iowa. And this amendment would nullify, or in other words, strike down any state or local law that sets a standard or condition for the production of any agricultural product. Now, that sounds like a mouthful, but what he's trying to do is stop states and localities from mandating that farm animals be raised in a more humane manner. In other words, that animals on these factory farms be given more space to move around. But because the language of his amendment is so broad, it would go much further than that. And it could strike down hundreds, possibly thousands of laws on any range of issues related to agricultural products.
Maybe you can give us examples of some of the specific laws that, if the King Amendment is part of the final bill approved by Congress and signed into law, what legislation that has been passed at the local level would be affected?
So much. Let's go through a couple of examples that are pretty distant from the animal cruelty topics that prompted this. Some states have regulations on the importation of firewood from other regions because there may be an invasive pest, like, for example, the Asian longhorn beetle, that lives in one region but does not live in another region. And so a place that's free from the Asian longhorn beetle or any number of other kinds of bugs may have regulations on the importation of firewood, which is timber is an agricultural product. And under the King Amendment, those would be struck down, and a state could not protect itself from products that could bring with them invasive pests. And numerous states have passed legislation requiring that cigarettes that are sold in a state be self-extinguishing or what they call fire safe. Well, because that is one state setting a standard or condition for an agricultural product that is produced in another state, then under the King Amendment, those laws would be struck down. There are some states that outlaw the slaughter of horses for human consumption. Those laws would be gone. There are about 10 states that outlaw what they call the gestation crate. And the gestation crate is this 2-foot-wide iron crate that mother pigs are placed into and held for their entire breeding period. And the reason that some of these big farms do that is because it allows them to cram more pigs into a smaller space. Maximum production with lower overhead. Well, a lot of states have said, no, no, that is ridiculously inhumane. The breeding mother pig should at least be able to turn around without scraping up against the side of the pen that they're confined in. Under the King Amendment, those laws would be in jeopardy. Mississippi has a state law prohibiting the consumption of dog meat. Now, there's not a lot of people that want to eat dogs, but Mississippi passed a law because they felt that for some reason they needed to pass that. Maybe there was someone down there that was eating dogs. Well, under the King Amendment, that's setting a standard or condition for an agricultural product, type of meat, so Mississippi would lose the right to prohibit the consumption of dogs. And it just goes on and on and on.
So is there a conference committee here that will have to hammer out differences between the Farm Bill and the House and the Senate, and that's when the vulnerable point is here for taking the King Amendment out? Or maybe you could explain to us the process here and the timeline in terms of action on the Farm Bill and the King Amendment.
So the Senate passed their version of the Farm Bill, which does not contain the King Amendment. And then the House passed their own version of the Farm Bill, which does contain the King Amendment. So now the Congress will have a conference committee, which is where a handful of people from the Senate will sit down with a handful of people from the House, and they'll iron out the differences between the two bills and then produce a final product for the Congress to try to agree on. And the Senate has already named the senators that they will send to the conference committee. The House has not yet done so. I think that in the coming weeks, the House will probably name their conferees, and then they can finally have the conference committee meet probably in October or maybe November. They were supposed to try to get it done in September, but in the House there's been a disagreement about the food stamp provisions in the Farm Bill, and that's prevented them from getting all the work done in the House of Representatives. So I would say within the next month or two, we're probably going to see this really come to a head.
That was John Goodwin, Director of Animal Cruelty Policy at the Humane Society of the United States. Find more information and links to activist groups opposing the King Amendment by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.